Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out on such a beautiful summer day. Aren't we lucky? This good weather has been going on for so long. Well, today, the title of the talk is Family of Sangha. I think for most of us, summer is a time when we travel to visit friends or family. And family members and friends perhaps come and visit us. And maybe these family members and friends are people you haven't seen for a long time. Or maybe you just see them a couple times a year. On special occasions like Thanksgiving and Christmas, that kind of thing. We all came from a family, and most of us still have family, whether it's relatives in the traditional sense, or if it's family as really a close group of friends. I like to talk about family in a personal way, about my own family a little bit, about the family that we do not choose, the family that we do not choose. I'd like to talk about family as Sangha. It's a little different from regular Sangha. Sangha, of course, being the Buddhist term that means the community, usually community of monks or nuns. Community that we join and participate in, and a community that we can perhaps leave. But family, a Sangha, is a little different. I call it the Sangha of No Escape. Kate came up with the title for this talk and kind of gave me a push to broaden my first idea, which was to talk about patience. And I will talk about patience a little bit more as I get going here. But this summer, I too visited family. But it was a visit forced by circumstances. I recently came back from 2 weeks in Calgary to see and help my younger brother, Jimmy, and his wife, Charlotte. Jimmy had a heart attack, followed by double bypass surgery. He's 53, been smoking since he was 14. Worked as a carpenter in construction for decades. And although he kept trying over and over again to quit smoking, he just was not successful. And I imagine it was just too hard for him. Because he was working with guys who smoked all around him. At any rate, Jimmy required surgery. The surgeon, however, stopped at two bypasses instead of doing more, which we found out later Jimmy did need, because the surgeon found the heart too damaged to risk longer surgery. Jimmy apparently had not just one heart attack, but several previous heart attacks that Charlotte, his wife, and I did not know about. He had three stents put in over the past 10 years and was warned each time by the doctors, stop smoking, stop smoking. Right after the heart surgery that Jimmy had, Charlotte called Kate and me because the surgeon did not give a very good prognosis. And Charlotte was understandably really upset. I had planned to go out there a week after the surgery, when Jimmy was expected to be discharged. But after talking with Charlotte, I rebooked and left the next day. Jimmy looked pretty grim when I arrived at the hospital. But over the 2 weeks I was there, he made a slow recovery and was discharged about a little under a week ago. So Jimmy's now home, he's stable, following his rehab regime, walking, resting, trying to eat well, and not smoking. But he has a long way to go. This is not a unique story, I know. It's a story of aging, of bodies becoming ill, bodies becoming worn, a story of crisis, a story of family. We all have stories of loss and tragedy, hope, and sometimes recovery. And they are really powerful stories. They are stories that can break open our heart to new depths of love and compassion, or they cover our hearts with an anger or ache that seems impossible to throw off. Family stories are particularly powerful in part because we have little choice about our family. No life appears from nothing. It constantly arises from life. We are born into a family. And even if we reject the whole of our family, or we reject some members, or even if the family members, if the members of our family are no longer alive, even then we still have ongoing relationships with our family members. So, in a way, as I said earlier, there is no escape from the muddle of family. Just as in Sangha life, as we typically understand the word Sangha, the benefits of a clear and intimate life with our family members can help us open our view of ourselves to include others. As we mature, our self-centeredness becomes softer, because in an intimate family, we naturally see others as part of ourselves. In the Metta Sutta, we chant, "Even as a mother at the risk of her life watches over and protects her only child, so with a boundless mind should one cherish all living things." And I think this illustrates the warmth and deep caring that can arise in family. If we grow up in a healthy family, if we grow up with a healthy family intimacy, there are long times when we don't feel that our own identity is really challenged or pushed aside or endangered in some way. In an intimate family, there's a large holding that allows you to simply be you. And this holding, I think, allows you to have a broader view and a closeness to other people. Because you're able to see their perspective, and you're able to hold your own perspective a little lightly. In this kind of intimate family, I think we tend to regard the feelings of others with almost the same import that we regard our own. And here we see with great clarity, I think, part of the Buddha's teaching. Because as the Second Noble Truth shows, that the source of all our suffering comes from excessive self-grasping, clinging, aversion. The families that foster support, or a kind of supportive, loving, and creative life for all its members, are pretty rare. Today, we talk about dysfunctional families as being the norm. I was once just visiting a class when the professor asked the students, how many people come from dysfunctional families? And I think almost everyone raised their hands. You know, given that families contain some pain, I think all families contain some pain, some tragedy, and families with huge pains, huge tragedy, turns out that they are pretty common. Given these things, how do we shift from reaction, from turning away, to being more open to responding? How do we recognize the past conditioning in our family and then set a new course? At first glance, it may seem that Buddha Dharma has really not much to say about family. Right? Buddha left home, bunch of celibate monks and nuns. But when we look closer at the early texts, there are actually quite a number of them that describe, for example, how a husband and wife should treat each other, using words like mutual generosity, respect, that the husband should always buy jewelry for his wife. How young children or youth should view their parents, again, with respect and honor, etc. And while it's true in the old stories that Shakyamuni leaves home, he does return. He returns and most of his family become lay practitioners, or they join the monastic order that he started. And throughout Buddhist history, monastics leave family, yes. But generally they maintain close ties to their family. They may take care of elderly parents. They may constantly dedicate the merit of their practice to their parents or to their families. And this is true of most Buddhist monastic communities today. Today, what does this tradition today offer us as we meet the pain and confusion in the Sangha of family? Well, of course, each family is unique, right? Each has its own complexity, and each requires from us a response. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we have really little choice in selecting our family, but we can have choice in how we respond. And this possibility of response, rather than a reaction, arises out of our very practice itself. When when we bring a deeply caring and respectful awareness to the way we interact with family, whether that family is in front of us or long gone, we change our relationships from a source of pain and confusion to one of transformation. Typically, though, most of our communication with a family can simply arise from a reaction born out of past hurts, born out of past conditioning. That's how often we relate to family. During his stay in the hospital, my younger brother Jimmy said to me, "You're the smart one. You never started smoking." Jimmy never went to university, as I and my older brother did. So we were labeled smart, and Jimmy was not. And when he said that, I felt profoundly sad, because it's not true. Jimmy is a bright and quite clever man. And this labeling arose simply out of his struggle with ADD. How often we label ourselves in the family, or are labeled in the family. Perhaps you were labeled as something or saw yourself in some way in the family. You know, one way that Zokitsu Norman Fisher, our teacher that ordained Kate and I, brings alive the fundamental Buddhist teaching of non-self is to point out that the person of the past is no longer present. That the conditions that have led to this present moment are infinitely complex. My brother of 14 is simply a half-baked memory at best. The conditions that prompted a young teenager to smoke and to keep smoking, like advertising, peer pressure, stress, bodily response, self-image, are really many and they change over time. For Jimmy to judge himself and create a sense of low self-worth is in part the illusion of a continuous self. As Norman puts it, it's not your fault, but it's your responsibility. Feelings of guilt and worthlessness are of little help, and we cannot, of course, change the past. But we can accept the consequences. We can learn from them, and then decide how to step forward. In Buddhist terms, this is part of right view. That quality of seeing things as they are, without judgment or criticism. For me, right view also includes a sense of not knowing. I don't know all the factors that make up my brother. I don't know all the many experiences that, at least in part, created his personality, that influence him to react in certain ways, to make certain choices. As I sat beside my brother right after his surgery, I found this view to be very helpful, because I could be with him in a way that allowed me to drop much of my initial surge of criticism He was just my brother in a painful and frightening situation. There is no one to blame. But a response is required. A response is required. In that initial surge of criticism was a sense of wanting to say, well, how could you? How could you keep smoking? And part of that was sparked from something my brother said. He said to me, I never thought it would come to this. I never thought it would come to this. My brother, who had 3 stents put in earlier, smoking since he was 14, told by a number of doctors to stop smoking. I never thought it would come to this. And I wanted to say something. What do you mean you never thought it would come to this? Of course. It's so obvious. The power of the human mind to delude itself is astounding. And yet, there is no one to blame. But a response is required. Another teaching that really helped me while I was in Calgary with my brother was a commitment to non-harming. In the list of precepts that we study, and in fact we'll chant in service today because it's the full moon, in that list, the precept of non-harming refers to not killing. But really it goes far beyond the literal killing of life. It goes to the practice of self-restraint. A cutting comment, a rebuttal or criticism that we know will diminish or in some way kind of kill another, is simply a way that feeds that sense of self. It's very easy, so easy to harm another through speech. Especially habitual or kind of compulsive speech. So I tried to be truthful to my brother, telling him I was afraid, worried, clear with what I was feeling. But I restrained my knee-jerk thoughts about his situation. Like, how could he do this to me and the family? Was smoking so important, etc. When the urge to blame or even agree with Jimmy's own self-criticism arose, I tried to respond with how I was feeling at that moment. Sad, relief, frightened, worried, glad. In my practice, I've come to not completely trust the thoughts that appear in my mind, because too many of them are simply old tapes wanting to be heard again. But perhaps the practice that helped me most was the practice of patience. In Mahayana Buddhism, patience is one of the perfections or qualities that a bodhisattva cultivates. Patience is the capacity to accept with some equanimity difficulty when it comes. Accept with a quiet strength and dignity. Typically, we meet frustration or we meet difficulty with frustration and fear. Typically, we try to avoid difficulty. And patience these days has, I think, kind of bad press. Patience is seen as a little bit wimpy, passive, maybe even a cop-out. But the Buddhist sense of presence is to meet adversity fully, to endure the times when we are afraid, when we are lost, when our strength is really worn down. Patience is cultivated as a practice because it fortifies all the other spiritual qualities. Now, the practice of patience appears pretty simple, but really, it's really challenging. Here's a little quote from Norman's book about the practice of patience, the book called Training in Compassion, his most recent book. And he writes, when difficulty arises, notice the obvious and not so obvious ways we try to avoid it. The things we say and do, the subtle ways in which our very bodies recoil and clench when somebody says or does something that we don't like. To practice patience is to simply notice these things and be fiercely present with them. Taking a deep breath helps. Returning to the mindfulness of the body helps. But we be present with them rather than reacting to them and flailing about. Paying attention to body, paying attention to mind. And when possible, giving ourselves good teachings about the virtue of being with rather than running away from. We need to be with the anguish we are feeling at this moment. Frankly, I don't like hospitals. And just sitting beside my brother in the hospital for a week, surrounded by the smells of poor food and medicines, the bustle of nurses, the soft groans of other patients, fluorescent lighting and the listlessness and confusion of my brother, that was pretty hard. I wanted to cut my visiting times shorter. I wanted to skip a day. I wanted Jimmy to be alert enough to have a good conversation. I wanted not to see so many others in deep distress. I wanted out. There are times when loving kindness, insight, mindfulness, intention, and even awareness seem to slip away. And what is left is just a commitment to be present. And this is the practice of patience. And I think this is what helped me most. Although not a precept or a perfection, the practice of just listening carried my relationship to my generally taciturn brother into new areas. Many years ago, I was given the practice of listening by one of my teachers. In meditation, this means using sounds as the object of meditation, bringing awareness to whatever you hear at that particular moment without following the thoughts that are sparked by the sound. So that's on the cushion. Off the cushion, the practice is much as we do during tea circle here. We give our full attention to the speaker, and put on hold our desire to reply. Just listen deeply. As my brother recovered in hospital, he became more aware of the gravity of his situation. He became somewhat depressed and recognized the pain that he caused those who love him. This pain caused through his inability to stop smoking. When he spoke, I just listened, occasionally asking for clarification or how he felt about what he had just said. My sense of Jimmy changed as he spoke about his own discomfort, his fear, and his confusion. He seemed more mature and open than I remembered him. And yet, what's strange is when I look back on those times that I listened to Jimmy, I note that my own discomfort and fear grew less as I gave myself to that careful listening. Family is Sangha. The most challenging place of practice for us. But also the place where compassion and insight may unfold and reveal a world rich and beautiful. If we're lucky, and if we're skilled, suffering and pain in a family becomes a shared concern. A part of everyone's life. It becomes clear that life's difficulties are not owned or caused by an individual, but flow out of myriad variables. Recognizing this, remaining open and vulnerable, and accepting with each other, we heal together. There's no escape from the muddle of family. But that can be what saves us from ourselves. At times we may feel we can do spiritual practice alone, by ourselves. We just need to read or hear the best teachings, perhaps see a teacher now again, do a few retreats. But this kind of self-improvement project will eventually crumble because it's missing a key ingredient. From the time of the Buddha, Sangha, working and living with others has been one of the three jewels of awakening. Bringing our practice of meditation and compassion and the precepts and insight to our relationships with family, with family members, all family members, nourishes the seeds of liberation. And while it's true that family relationships are often charged, family is also the Sangha that more than any other reflects back to us that we are not alone. We're not alone in our fears or wants or suffering. And in doing so, reveals deep clarity and love. So whether you have rejected the whole of your family, or some members, or even if the members of your family are no longer alive, how will you use your practice to truly meet your family? How can we use our practice together to make family a place of transformation? Just as the Buddha did with his family. hesitated to talk about family. Family is so personal. So personal. And yet, family is such a deep place of practice for us. Maybe the deepest, because there is something about family, the great stories of our religious histories in the West are really all about family. The Old Testament, for example, much of the New Testament, the Jewish tradition, so many stories about family. And that's also true in Asia. Family. We all struggle with family. And yet, maybe it is what makes us most human. Most able to reach out to all people in the world. Otherwise, maybe we'd all become hermits somewhere in the mountains, living off berries and whatever we could scrounge, be quite content. So I hope this has been a little helpful, but if not, as we say sometimes in the Shuso closing ceremony, please wash out your ears with the clear sounds of the Dharma. Thank you for listening.
Page 3.